RS Interview.
V tokratnem RS intervjuju se pogovarjamo z zvočno performerko Marijo Chavez, nedavno gostjo koncertne serije festivala Sonika. Njen nastop smo lahko doživeli v soboto, 15. junija v kinu Šiška, skupaj z argentinsko producentko in ter vokalistko Morito Vargas in domačim ambientalnim duom Lip Rouge. Chavez je sodobna konceptualna umetnica, ki se pretežno sicer ukvarja z zvokom, vendar njena praksa priči mnogo medijev. Vibracije zvoka razume kot gradnike efemernih zvočnih skulptur, ki se tvorijo v specifičnem časoprostoru, ter so si zato medsebojno vedno različne. Svojo prakso je pričela kot DJ-ka, ki jo je fasciniral preskok gramofonske igle na plošči in šum, ki ga je ta povzročil, pa tudi naključna ujemanja zvočnega materiala, ki so tako nastala. Pod mentorstvom Pauline Oliveiros in njenega improvizacijskega kroga v Houstonu v Združenih državah Amerike se je izurila v praksi globokega poslušanja ter svojo zvočno prakso premikala vse dlje. Postala je mednarodno prepoznavna turntablistka in izstopajoča ustvarjalka v polju sodobnega eksperimentalnega gramofonarstva. Pred koncertom v kinu Šiška nas je obiskala tudi v studiih Radija Študent.
Hi, Maria. Welcome to our studio.
Hi, how are you?
So, let's start maybe with your introduction to our listeners.
Well, I feel like my work straddles a lot of different areas of work, whether it be in the art industry or music industry, but I'm mainly known as a conceptual sound artist, abstract turntablist, and DJ.
All right. Tonight, although we are listening this afterwards, you're also playing in Kino Shishka.
Yep.
For the Sonika event.
Ooh, so excited. It's going to be so fun.
What are you preparing? How do your, what does turntabling mean? How do you perform? What are your strategies?
Well, I wrote a book about my practice in 2011. It's called Of Technique, Chance Procedures on Turntable. And it's a collection of essays and illustrations of lessons that I've learned through improvising on one turntable with a collection of broken records and needles over the span of, at the time, about a decade. Now, if I were to rewrite the book, I'd have to add a new section because I'm the only abstract turntablist in the world that uses a special needle. It's called a rake, a double-headed needle. So it's two needles on one head. And so it reads two different parts of a record at the same time. And then you can split each needle per channel. So then it gives you two sonic sound sources rather than just the one. And so for tonight, so grateful to the festival, Martin and everyone, for being able to find four turntables and two DJ mixers, right, because now I have four double-headed needles. So it'll be eight needles, four turntables, and because of Radio Student, you guys gave me some records from here, old 78s and some 45s and some other regular records that I'll break and perform with to make the performance tonight a more site-specific sonic experience. But ultimately, my practice as an abstract turntablist has evolved around the idea of the work isn't, to me, music. It just emits sound. I actually feel that I've been a sculptor this whole time, and the chisel is the needle, and the material you subtract is the vinyl. And so really what you're hearing when you watch me perform is you're hearing a sculpture session in progress, but you can't actually see the sculptures because they're so small. And so I liken it to painting your name on a piece of rice. It's like that micro sculpture making, but the only way you can experience it is sonically. And so with that in mind, I've now adapted my practice into actually making marble sculptures where the imagery is based on magnified images of vinyl records. And now I can actually finally put those miniature sculptures that I've been making through these performances into stone. And so that's why I wanted to start off saying that my practice spans many genres. It's not just musicianship. I'm actually not interested in music. That's why I consider myself a conceptual sound artist. Music is a language of sound. I know a lot of Cajun people will want to argue with me, and I'm more than happy to have that argument. But I personally feel that my interest in sound has more to do with the natural phenomenon of sound and how it involves itself into everyday life. Like when you hear thunder and lightning, that's not because someone performed it. It's just a natural phenomenon that emits sound. And so if you can draw parallel to my performance, that's how I see my turntablism performances. I'm not trying to make good music choices. I'm trying to create an improvised performance where you're literally watching the sound unfold in front of you. And then it's up to you if your mind wants to make it sonically musical. On top of that, I'm on a turntable where there's a rotating motor. So there's a natural rhythm that is already inherent to the machine that I try not to divorce from the performance itself. But with that being said, I think we all have a natural rhythm because we have our heartbeats. Mm. And I prefer to work with sound as a medium, as an artist, because I feel that it's the most democratic of all the mediums, because at least deaf people can feel sound. Mm. Blind people can feel sound waves with my sculptures, and you can touch the art with my marble sculptures, which is what I love about this next phase of my practice.
But what would you say you question through all these art practices that you're involved with? Like, so there are different mediums of sculpture, of textile, I saw, like, of there is like performative aspects of breaking the vinyls and so on. But what would you say is the main question for you that you're addressing? Why are you going on? Why did you even start?
Well, I started because at the time I wasn't safe and I wasn't being heard. And I found the DJ format, the performance presentation of it, I had an affinity towards it because I finally found a way to be seen and to be heard because I wasn't, as a child, protected. And I wasn't safe, and I wasn't being heard. And so really, my whole career is based on trauma. But it evolved into this amazing body of work where chance and life just took me on this wild ride, and I just hung on for dear life, and now I'm here. And so if you want to get down to like the personal philosophy of it, the reason why it all evolved into what I'm doing now is because I think I needed to find a space where someone would hear me. And then as the work evolved and as I was starting to make these little accidents into performance, I was being guided by my mentor, Pauline Oliveros, and David Dove, who started the Pauline Oliveros Foundation in Houston. I grew up in Houston, Texas. I was born in Peru, but I grew up in Texas, and I've been in New York City since 2005. But while I was in Houston, I got pushed out of the DJ scene. I was a DJ very young, at 17 years old. Yeah. I was DJing in clubs for 20-year-olds. Like, I shouldn't have been there, but I didn't have supervision. I've pretty much been living alone since I was 15. I had, like, a nanny, but I was able to go out on a weekday as a 17-year-old in high school and DJ clubs because I didn't really have anyone to tell me what to do. And as fun as it sounded, it's not a good environment for a child to grow up in. But anyway, I was in this environment as a DJ, DJing vinyl records in 97, 98, 99, house music and techno and drum and bass, mainly French disco house. And then one day I was listening to a record with an old boyfriend, and he stepped out of the room, and when he left, the needle on this one record that was playing somehow popped up, jumped up, and then fell back down and landed on the groove of the record, the surface area of the record, in a way that it sounded intentional. it sounded so clean. Mm. And I was like, oh, that was cool. And so then I tried to do it again myself. And he ran into the room, he's like, oh, what are you doing? It was like the biggest fight we ever had. And and that was pretty much the response of every man that saw me as my career developed and I was breaking these records and these needles and performing them in these situations. It was as if I was killing these people. And I realized, like, I must be doing something right here if this is causing such a reaction from so many people. And then ultimately, by seeing this reaction, I realized, oh, this is a very anti-capitalist type of practice, and it's recycling because I'm taking old records. I don't really search for new records. I don't buy them. I'm really interested in what already exists out there. And then I can take it and reformat it in a way that fits my performance practice and gives them a new life as well, or else they'd just be like here, just hiding in a box somewhere with no one to listen to them. Now the records here will get a new life tonight with me.
I'm looking forward.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to hear what's going to be on them, because it's also about chance. It's not really about my predetermined ideas. I want the city to give me the sonic choices, and then I have to sit there in front of all of you guys and be like, I don't know what's going on here. Let's find out together. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that practice that really brings the audience in. I also think it's the motion of the turntable too. It's very hypnotic. It's rotation. Also, rotation is why we have digital media now, why playback technology even exists. Once humans realize that all they had to do was throw some magnetic dust on a spinning cylinder, and that would emit sound, that completely changed the face of the world, of technology-wise. So the action of the spiral, of the circle rotation, I think physics-wise is something that really fascinates me. And so pulling all of this together with the anti-capitalism as well, in the practice, I realized, like, this is actually a performance, political performance, disguised as a record performance, because pretty much what I'm saying is these objects, even as they're broken, still have value to me. So when I always bring up this quote by Yoko Ono, where she says she doesn't like the word optimist because it still implies that the person that's optimistic is a fool. And so I draw a parallel to that with the word destroy or ruin. It's like it's just assumed that once it's broken, once it's ruined, it's useless. But in my practice, once you break it, it actually becomes something new and important and more valuable than when it was whole. And just by presenting that in a space, I've found really inspires a lot of people and makes them rethink not just the playback technology that I'm working with and the material, but themselves and how they interact with their own practice. And it's something that I wasn't expecting. I'm really grateful that it translates in that way.
Right. Yeah, it goes a lot with the technique of collage, the destruction.
Absolutely.
The destruction of the material too, that creates something new, and like the maybe the appearance of photomontage was the one that was shocking with combining these materials. So
and yeah. It's also musique concrète in the 50s and 60s, it's very similar. Also, when I break the records, you'll see I have them like on the ground, out in a certain way. Sometimes just with chance, just how it breaks, how it falls on the floor, just leave it, because that's a visual musique concrète. We don't actually know what those sounds are, but when you break a record, what you're actually doing is creating an unintentional sample. So when I tell people, you know, you have your music WAV file on your digital audio workspace, right? And it's in a rectangle shape with a little squiggly line inside. And then you can take your cue and you can click on it and edit and delete parts that you don't want and parts that you do want. And a vinyl record is pretty much the same thing, but it's a circle. And so then when you break it, instead of you putting the cues and deleting what you want, the record is giving you the sample that it wants you to have. That's how I romanticize it, at least. And in that way, it is reflective of the Fluxus era of musique concrète, of these visual collage works and things. That's why I like my fabric works. The really large piece I did in Houston, that was all donated by the city of Houston. And then I assembled it with a team of 8 people for about 2 weeks. It was 20,000 square foot abandoned loading dock. So they wanted me to make a sound installation in a space that was open 24/7. Anyone could walk in there. I'm like, well, we can't have electronics in here. It'd be stolen by day one. Like, how do you want me to make a sound installation in a space where people will be able to access it 24/7? And I was like, oh, right, the other side of sound, which is absorption. So sound emits, and then we absorb. And so it's been a series of mine called absorption sculptures. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much that fabric piece was an absorption sculpture meant to absorb sound in that space. Because when you first entered without the piece in it and you clapped, the echo was about 3 seconds long. It was a very big space, very acoustically resonant. And then when my piece was made and we covered all of the areas that we could with this fabric, it absorbed the sound, and then the echo is only 2 seconds long. So I made an absorption sculpture that absorbed a second of sound. And that to me was like a big, for a 20,000 square foot concrete space, that was a big deal. But also visually, what I was creating, and I didn't realize it at the time until it made itself, was I was making a visual history of this city that I grew up in, of Houston, because these were all fabrics donated by these people that I don't know, but they wanted to participate in this work. And then they were coming and looking at all of the pieces that I put together, like, that's mine, or I used to have a bedspread like that, or this, and it had a different history to it that I didn't even think about when I was first making the piece. It showed itself to me in that way. So it utilized itself as an absorption sculpture for sound, but also a visual history of the area. And I feel like when I break records and leave them on the floor, it's a very similar process. It's a visual sonic history on the floor. It's just that it's visual samples rather than you being able to hear it. Because really, if you were to play like a little shard, it would be like blip, 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 which is also fun to play on a turntable, and I highly recommend it.
So also, yeah, it's the principle that you're going through, like through many mediums, like searching for these samples. You mentioned Pauline Oliveros.
Yes.
What was inspiring with her, or what was the experience you had? You were also from the same city, right?
Yeah, she was born in Houston. I moved to Houston when I was 8. And then met this group of wild improvisers and artists that all worked with Pauline and David Dove of a now Nameless Sound Collective in Houston, but at the time it was the Pauline Oliveros Foundation. And pretty much as the techno boys were pushing me out of the scene because I was making this needle pop up too much and it was driving them crazy, they kicked me out one day because I was being too experimental in a DJ set. They're like, you're never going to DJ in Houston again. And that was in 2000. And they were right. I didn't DJ again in Houston until 2017. But I just had to wait for the regime change. I love a good regime change. Now I can play there when I want. But it was a very long time. And all that to say that because they pushed me out, they sort of shoved me towards the abstract and the art. And that was when I met David Dove and Pauline. And the first show that I went to was a free jazz show with Joe McPhee and Dominique Duval, Trio X, that Dave was putting on as part of the Pauline Oliveros Foundation. And it was being held in an art gallery. And I was like, I didn't know you could have a show performance in an art gallery. What a weird thing. I was like 20 at the time, you know. I was like, I got to check this out because I don't have any friends anymore. So I might as well, you know, go see what's going on. And I saw this show, and at the end, the last performance, Joe pulled out a little flower from his pocket. He's like, we took a walk, and I saw this flower, and I just thought it was so beautiful. It was really small, little weed flower, you know, not like a rose or something. And he set it on the music stand, and he said, for our last piece, we're going to play this flower. And I was just there, you can do that? I didn't know you could do that. And then I heard it, and I was like, that was amazing. And after that, I went to Dave and I said, I really want to work with you guys. And I was getting my audio engineering degree at the time and I needed an internship. And he said, well, you can work with us, but you have to participate in my after-school improvisation workshops that I teach. And that's the only way so that you can understand, like, what this is all about. And I was like, well, I'm not a musician, I'm a DJ. He's like, well, bring a turntable and let's see what happens. And that was when I put the two together. It's like, I can show them this weird needle thing that I've been doing that got these all these boys mad about and see what they think. And they pretty much just took me in and they were like, this is actually a whole history. There's like people that have been ruining vinyl since the 50s. You're just, and the fact that I thought it was something brand new, the fact that there was this history to it was incredible to me. I was like, oh my gosh, what an amazing moment that I found these people that are listening to me, that are hearing me, giving me space, making me feel safe, and allowing me to experiment. And I didn't realize that these workshops were based on Pauline Oliveros' practices of deep listening, because he was part of the director of the Pauline Oliveros Foundation. But I didn't really know who she was at the time. And she would come and see us, and we would be performing her pieces, and she would give us some advice. And when she first saw me play, she was like, this is great. And I was like, really? You think so? She's like, yeah, you're like, don't stop. Like, this is, you're really onto something. And that word of encouragement, even though I didn't really know who she was at the time, really meant the world to me, because someone was hearing me. And then over time, she just took me under her wing and like was responsible for getting me a lot of fellowships, residencies. We toured a lot together. Very, very grateful to have had her in my life. I miss her terribly now that she's gone. But really, what she left behind is a body of work that has pretty much changed the face of improvisation and sound art and how you approach it. And I think as an icon in sound art, Pauline made her mark because she created the sonic meditations for everyone in 73, 74. And that was like one of the first times besides like Fluxus stuff where she was approaching everyone as a musician, not just the special few that learned how to play instruments. She was pretty much saying, here's a written score you can play too, and including everyone. And Dave took that energy and that compassion and created this organization and these after-school improvisation workshops that pretty much set me up for my whole career now.
So something that was perceived as an error with the boys,
exactly,
became like your, I'd say, working method even, or your instrument.
Absolutely, yeah. So the value of the mistake, you know?
Exactly, I want to go there. Like, I want to understand how you started to understand improvisation, or how this, like, this understanding evolved, and yeah, what is an error in, like, what kind of role it has inside.
That question will never stop being interesting to me, which I think is why it's so inspiring, because so many people get stuck, even as creative people, they'll get stuck in whatever they're doing, and I'm always being challenged, because even if I don't like something that's happening in a performance, I have no choice but to eat my own words and be like, chance, Maria, like, like, you don't want it to sound good, like, you have to stand on that, and it's always so challenging. But it was all based on Pauline's deep listening practices. Pretty much now when people ask me, like, how do you deep listen? I'm like, I don't really know. I do it. I just do it all the time, because I'd been doing it 3 to 4 days a week for like 4 hours a day with this group of people, deep listening. And so now I just do it, and I don't even realize it when it happens. But pretty much what Pauline taught me was it's not that you want to make a sound as intention. You want to make a sound because deep in the bottom of your heart, you know it belongs right there. And you have to make that sound. And she told me this story about when she was studying dolphins in the sea parks. Mm-hmm. She wanted to make instruments for dolphins. She was so ahead of her time. And she learned that if you put a little waterproof marker on a dolphin and you put a mirror in the tank and you mark it, it'll go to the mirror and it'll look at itself. And she's like, so the dolphin has self-awareness. And she noticed that sometimes when the trainer would go with the fish and be like, up, and the dolphin would have to swim around and jump up and get the fish and go back down. She said, sometimes I notice that the dolphin would just keep going in circles and circles and just didn't want to do what the trainer was making it do, and would just mess with the trainer. And but she noticed that there would be this moment of intensity and tension where suddenly you could see the fight in the dolphin's brain of its self-awareness wanting to mess with the trainer, but then the animal instinct of wanting the fish. And then suddenly you just burst out of the water and grab the fish and circle around in the pool all mad at itself because it couldn't keep itself from jumping out even after trying to swim and swim and swim. And she told me, she's like, so be the dolphin. When don't play just to have a place. Wait until you can't wait any longer. This is exactly where it needs to happen. This is, and it has to burst out of you. And she taught me that when I was like 22. And that's how I've been performing ever since. And like watching chance with this fragile machinery interact with this material, and then being like, no, I think I want this one to do this now, or this. And then somehow that is what creates the sonic improvisations, how it pulls it all together.
What meaning then has decision in the improvisation process? Like, how do you perceive decision? From which place it comes?
Oh, gosh. You're asking some hard questions, huh? I guess it just depends on the day and what mood I'm in. And, you know, it's very, you know, because everywhere you go, you have different experiences. And and it's also hard to be a professional in this world. So it really just depends. But I think ultimately, I've also been performing for so many years now. I'm 44 now. This is a really long career. So now it's just like with deep listening, I just sort of settle into it. When I make my choices, I don't even think about it anymore. I'm just like, like,
that's also what practice does, right?
Yeah, because you're just always in practice with deep listening and improvising. And I collaborate, like my trio with Victoria Shen and Maria Mirzai. We all have our own roles within our trio, turntablism trio, and I improvise with other musicians. And one thing that Pauline taught me early on too was everybody in my improvisation group in Houston, a majority of them were acoustic instruments, so flutes and violins and guitars and things, some electric guitars, but I was really the only one that was powered, where there were speakers. And she went up to me one day and she was like, one thing I want you to think about is you have a lot of power. And I was like, power. She's like, yeah, power. And then she like unplugged and the sound from the speakers sucked all the sound in the room. She's like, that's a big responsibility. And you're playing with these people that are acoustic. And how do you give them balance with how much power you have? And I was just like, whoa. And after that, I was very, very considerate and really knowing how much power I had, always tried to work with different types of musicians in a way where I didn't take over the space. And that really taught me a lot about choice as well. Because again, it's not just playing to be heard. It's making a choice that you feel really does belong there at that moment, while the machinery is also interacting with whatever's happening as well. And the combination of the two is what creates an interesting composition or sound piece.
Yeah, you're usually performing solo, but you also had a lot of collaborations
yes.
with other people.
Yes.
Would you like to maybe highlight some, or what were they bringing to you? What can more people do in comparison to one, and what can one do in comparison to many?
Yeah, there's my trio, of course, with the girls. We're the best in the biz. I'm so proud of us. We are an amazing trio. Victoria Shen is is a genius, mad scientist. She can build speakers inside of record. Like, she's always thinking of amazing things to build, but a lot of her focus the last few years has been turntables, and she invented the needle nails, where you attach needles to your nails and you can play it.
Amazing.
And she actually used to be a manicurist, so it actually is in line with her practice. And as soon as, like, the video went viral, and I wake up to like 80 emails and tags, and everyone's just like, "Have you seen this? Have you seen this?" And I'm like, first of all, my branding worked, because whenever anyone sees anything turntable, they come to me, which is amazing, and I'm so honored. But also, this needs to be in a museum today. Like, it was so brilliant when I first saw it, and I was like, who is... Like, I knew who she was. We had, like, mutual friends, but I didn't know that she was interested in this. And so, and then, of course, going viral as a person of color, especially someone that identifies as female, isn't fun. I went viral in 2018 for a video, a New Sounds video from NPR in America, which was like, I got 200,000 views in an hour, something like that. It was really intense. Mm. A lot of vitriol with the men, because of course, guys don't like it when girls break stuff, which is fine. So I understood, but she had like 2 million, which is a totally different... But I was also in a different time of social media than her. Instagram reels and things like that wasn't really around back then, where it is now, which is funny how social media has evolved so quickly in the last few years, but that's a whole other conversation. But anyway, so I saw her. She went viral. I just happened to share a Zoom lecture with Mariam Rezai at the time, who I was a big fan of, but that was actually our first time meeting each other for this lecture. And afterwards, I reached out to her, and I was like, look, Victoria just went viral for this amazing object that she invented, and I feel like if you're into it, it would be cool, since we're both turntablists, to just reach out to her in solidarity and just be like, we know how scary it is to go viral. We hope you're okay. Please reach out if you need anything. And she got back in touch and was really grateful that we reached out, and Mariam had a podcast called These Are the Breaks, and she wanted us to have a chat. And so all three of us had a two-hour chat where we started off with gear, and then we went into the business, and like how hard it is to be us in the world, which is amazing to have a group of people to talk about this stuff with. And after the podcast, I wrote them. I was like, look, I don't think this has ever existed in music or art history before. We're all women of color on a turntable. I think we should be a trio and perform together. And sure enough, they thought about it and agreed. And then from that, once we got our press release out, we were on the cover of The Wire. Everybody was ready. It was like the world was ready for us. And we're such a fantastic group. We're politically really challenging. I was saying yesterday at lunch with the eclectic people that it's... Mariam is British-Iranian, and I was making the example of if we were to enter Iran and perform our trio there, they would kill us on the spot, because to show so much freedom, creative freedom in a space like that is completely unheard of. It's not allowed. And so I'm really proud of this trio for being able to present itself, not just that we're all badasses and we're really good and we sound amazing together, but we're also presenting absolute freedom and safety on stage as women of color who 50 years ago wouldn't have had the same opportunities of freedom that we do now. And it's a trio that I'm very proud of, and really grateful that the girls were willing to go for it. And we have been touring all over the world together. We'll be playing Big Ears Festival next year in America. We'll do an America tour next year. We just did Donau Festival and Archipel Festival in Geneva last month. So everything seems to be moving along. But hopefully in the future we'll have more presentations other than performance for exhibitions of all of our solo works and our trio works, and give workshops and things like that to show all of our different perspectives of the turntable, to really give people a scope of this object, from the mad scientist Victoria to crazy hands Mariam to me and my broken subtleties. It's an amazing collaboration.
Yeah, mentioning workshops, I think it's also, like, I don't know how you perceive it, but one in a row of anti-capitalistic activities.
Absolutely.
That you mentioned today. But yeah, sharing knowledge, right?
Yeah, Skillshare. Yeah. So, normally my workshops start with the Skillshare. I pretty much give you a basic rundown of signal flow, audio engineering signal flow, but with why the turntable works and how to connect it, from connecting it to the DJ mixer, connecting the DJ mixer to the speakers, and why that all works. And then, of course, explaining why the needle emits sound from these grooves of the records. And then the next hour, we throw that all out the window and we break everything. And it's really, really fun.
I can't imagine.
My goal is I want to teach as many people as I can while I'm alive to break a record. I think everyone should break a record in their life, because there's something about the neuron connection of that break, that first snap, you'll never forget it. And that was also something that I take it so for granted because I do it all the time. But when I watch the students do it for the first time, they're so scared, especially like the audiophile guys, like, oh, I can't do it. And I'm like, come on. We don't live in a Disney movie here. It's not like you're going to pour a coffee in, you know, in a tea glass and then it's going to sing to you. You know, like, we can break what we want. It's okay. And once they get past that and they break it, their eyes light up. Everyone, it never fails. It's an amazing experience. And it's also another part of my work from my brain surgery and stuff, of neuron connections. And that's really what my role as an artist is. And I think all artists is, we're here to exercise society's neuroplasticity, regardless of what our ideas are. The fact that we're presenting new ideas, whether it's to a small group of people or to 1 million, 2 million people, you're presenting a new idea, which is connecting new neurons in someone's mind, which is exercising their neuroplasticity. And the more our neuroplasticity is exercised, the easier, or not easier, but the more productive and proactive we can be with society and all of the scary changes of what the world has to face every day. And so ultimately, as a whole, I think it's really important to have these workshops and provide this moment of a true neuron connection that's going to stick in your head forever. And that in itself, I think, is worth everything.
Tell me for the end, like, the past, your past is dance, like exhibitions, books, performances, festivals.
Mm-hmm.
What is the future?
I want to be covered in marble, baby. that is still the same. You know, I had a 5-year hiatus healing from a brain surgery. I was cured of a very rare brain disorder, but it was a very long recovery process. And I just started touring, not this last January, but the January before. Mm. So it's really just, thank you. I appreciate that. It's a true blessing and a miracle, really. My neurosurgeon didn't think I'd be able to come back in the way that I have, and he's really, really happy with my progress, and I'm just so grateful to be alive, frankly, but also to be cured of my disorder and to be able to come back without having this albatross that had taken over a majority of my 30s. My first symptoms started when I was 33, 34, and my surgery was when I was 39, so it was a very long process just to get to the surgery itself. And so I just hope I can come back. I don't think I'll ever be able to tour pre-brain surgery Maria style. She was wild and crazy. But I hope to be able to continue to share my work with the world, continue to make these marble sculptures now and show them in more museums that thankfully have already been shown at Columbia University and a few other museums in the States. Hoping for maybe an exhibition in London next year for them. And yeah, just continuing to evolve the trio and some other collaborations with some other friends. And just seeing now that I'm back and I'm back without this weight on my shoulders of my disorder, I'm like, wow, like I can actually really think and really be creative without having to think about this other thing. It's amazing. And every day is a blessing. So I just hope to continue to make the work and probably write a few more books and see what happens.
Poslušali ste intervju z zvočno umetnico in DJ-ko Mario Chavez, ki je nastopala na nedavnem koncertnem ciklu festivala Sonika, ki je nastal v sodelovanju z londonsko organizacijo za eksperimentalni zvok Eclectic. Oddajo je pripravila Saba.
Ja. RS Interview.